Ben Helfgott, Reel 12.
From time to time, I was sent to another part of the factory where there were French women working. They were French women, prisoners of war. And it was the first time that I saw in my life women with their hair shaved off. When I saw them, that was again one of the great shocks that I encountered those days, because one is always used to looking at a woman with full of hair and so on, and that one cannot really appreciate to look what a woman looks like without hair. And on top of it, of course, although they didn't look like we did, they were not as emaciated as we were, because they had parcels sent from home, and they got extra food, and somehow they were thin, but reasonably normal, at least normal in my eyes. But where they looked so very abnormal was the lack of hair. So when I first came in the first time, they must have seen me. They must have noticed my sudden sort of shock, because one of them, they sort of smiled at me. One of them smiled at me. In fact, there was a mother and a daughter. They smiled at me, and they sort of begged me to come over, and they asked me where I work, and I couldn't really understand very much, so we tried to converse in German. They were a little German. They knew a little bit of German. My German was quite good, actually. And so I told them we worked and so on. The next time, when I went there again to pick something up, near the box where I was picking things up, there was a piece of, there was some, wrapped up some food, and there was some bread. And I thought to myself, my God, this is absolutely marvelous. I mean, this was the first piece of extra food that I've had. It was after about, I think, a month or 5 weeks that I was there. And then I always try to find any excuse if there's anything to be taken to that place, and I try to go there. Because whenever I used to go there, there was always something for me. And always these same two, it was a mother and a daughter, and they told me they came from a very aristocratic family. They were watched by the women overseers, so I had to be very careful, very discreet how it was done, because if I were to be caught, of course, it would be confiscated, and on top of it, I would have got a hiding, and they would have got a hiding, and I would have never been able to go there. So it was quite a job to maneuver it. Anyway, it wasn't, you learn these things. It was part of the things that you learn very quickly. And I was very quick, and under normal conditions, and especially when it was a question of survival. So I soon learned the art very, very well. Then something else happened that started helping me, and that was the German women, when they realized that the war is really coming to an end, that the Germans are losing the war. Because now the Russians attacked once again, and with one onslaught, they were at the German border, and they were fighting already in Germany. And so they thought, well, perhaps this is one way of buying their future, so to speak, and they started bringing a little bit of food. It wasn't much, but whatever it was a lifesaver. Occasionally, I managed to grab some, I was passing by near the kitchen, and I managed to grab some carrots or whatever. And so I managed, after, so as I said, everything takes time. You start learning, you get a little bit more confident. I was getting a little bit here and a little bit there, and of course all this made a lot of difference to me. It also made a lot of difference to my supporting my will. Now, something happened to me at the time that it upset me greatly, but also at the same time gave me extra strength. I was next to me where I was working were two sisters, very young. One was about 17 or 18, the other one was about 19 or 20. They were really newcomers to the place because they were forcibly sent out from Aachen, evacuated from Aachen. When the Germans were retreating from Aachen, they forcibly evacuated many of the local people. And in some cases it was against their will. Well, I say this obviously was forcible. And I think in their case, I think they must have, they realized that it was the end of the war. The father, who was also working there, used to come and occasionally seemed to have been sort of rather jovial and nice. And they were very amenable and approachable, and the girls were... would never do anything. They wouldn't raise their voice, and on the contrary, they always tried to talk to me and to the other boy. So from this point of view, it was really a great relief. And one day I summoned my courage and I said to one of them whether she minds if I were to go for a ride during lunchtime, lunch break, on the bike, because I haven't been on a bike for many years. And she said, sure, with pleasure, go. So, lunchtime came, I went, took her bike, I got on the bike, I started cycling, and I was so happy. I forgot about my hunger, I forgot about the danger, I forgot about everything, because suddenly I was cycling. I felt good, I felt strong. And I thought to myself, now, are definitely going to make it. And suddenly, one of the local German Hitlerjugend, Hitler Youth, who used to come to visit a place because he was wooing one of the younger girl. She didn't like him, though she always used to reject him, but he nevertheless used to come there. Suddenly he saw me on the bike. He stopped me and he says, how dare you cycling here? And who gave you permission? I said, I forgot the name of the girl. I said, so-and-so. She gave you, she had no right to give it to you. I said, look, I wouldn't take it. I would without asking. So he said, we will see. Well, when he went to see her, of course, he didn't talk to her like he talked to me. He talked very softly and he says, look, did you let him have it? And she says, yes, I did. So he very nicely, quietly said to her, but you know that you're not allowed because that means fraternization. How can you do it? So she said to him, look, mind your own business, you know. It's nothing to do with you. He says, well, I've got a good mind to denounce you. So she said to him, you try it. Anyway, he was so angry that he went up to me and he poured out his anger on me and he gave me a hiding. I was furious. I just felt all I want to do is to defend myself. If he beats me, why can't I fight him back? I knew if I were to hit him back, that would be the end of me. I was really holding myself back, but all I wanted was just to fight him. I would have tore him apart at that moment. But I said, you've got time. Take your time. Don't control yourself. Anyway, so he stopped beating me. And when it came to my turn, when it came to collecting my soup, he went up, got hold of the soup, instead of pouring it into my tin plate. He poured it on the floor. He said, that's what you're going to have. And that's what's going to happen to you for the next 2 days. Now, that soup was absolute rubbish. But to me, it was my life. And I looked at him again. I thought to myself, you so-and-so, if I ever get hold of you one day, I will give you a chance. I thought exactly the same what I thought a year or so earlier, when I was beaten up unjustly, and I felt exactly the same. I thought, if I am beaten up, at least why not get a chance to fight? As an always, I had this sort of naive. When I think back, I was so naive of this fairness of if somebody fights somebody, that one must not in any way interfere with another one. And I'm often reminded. I have a friend. Who was in the same comes from the same hometown, and he always tells me, and he always tells everybody this story, how one day one of our friends fancied himself as a great boxer, and the two of them started started fighting, and this one had they had some supporters, and he says how I made sure that if the two are going to fight, that that's not just going to be the two of them fighting and nobody else is going to be interfering. It's got to be fair. The one who is stronger is the one that's going to win. There is no way that anybody can. And he always tells everybody how this sort of about my approach to it. And this is how I really was. So I still think like this now in terms of fairness, you know. But at that time I was naive to the point of being childish about it. Anyway, that passed, and I could only. And all I was thinking about at that stage is about food, and I was thinking how I could ever get hold of this man, and I was thinking of the other man. I was still thinking about these two people, both because they were young and because they were nearing my age and so on. I somehow felt that. Anyway, this went by, and around the same time, James thinks the meter. We were hearing that the front is getting nearer and nearer, and more bombing was taking place, and all around us, we could hear the bombing, and we could see the flames from the distance, and one night, we were walking up, and we went out. And what we saw, we could not believe. The sky was red. And we could hear constant bombing and bombing and bombing. And we were about 70 miles away from Dresden. And you've heard of the famous Dresden bombing. That is that night. And I remember that night because I was 70 miles away and I could hear it and I could see the skies. The following day, when they came to work, the German women, they looked very depressed, very sad. And they were all talking about this terrible bombing that took place in Dresden and the carnage that took place. And to me, it was music to my ears. It was something, I was getting such pleasure out of it. I must admit, that's how it was. For the first time, I was beginning to feel that God is taking is back in business, is taking revenge, and then they started. There were alarms during the day, and when there were alarms, then we had to stop work, and we went into the fields, and what a relief that was.
What were they like? Air raids?
Air raids. They were air raids. And so we went out and we didn't work. And that was a great relief. Didn't have to. Of course, this was already in March. The weather was getting milder a little bit. Sun was coming out as well. Altogether, things looked much better. But in the meantime, the people in the camp were being decimated. They were falling like flies.
How many would have been in this camp, approximately?
Oh, they must have been about 2,000 people.
What was the sanitation arrangements?
Sanitation arrangements? There were no sanitation arrangements.
What did you do
about? Well, we just went in the camp. We went out in the woods. So there were some sort of makeshift toilets. No paper.
Like chemical toilets or just
pits? No, just pits. Just pits. You had to stand up. It was terrible. No facilities of any kind.
What would the guards use? What did the guards have? What were their facilities?
Oh, they had their places. They had their toilets and everything. They were pits, and that was it. We had to stand up, and that was the conditions were absolutely terrible. I thought we were being eaten up by the bugs and so on. But one night I woke up, and I sort of felt that something was. I thought something was sort of aching me. I thought there must have been a piece of. There must have been some stone or something. So I cleared it up, and I was lying on my side. And again, I could feel. Then I sort of thought, "What can it be?" So I sort of felt my buttocks, and suddenly I realized that I had no buttocks. It was all gone. All I had were bones. I just felt my bone, and all the flesh was gone. I couldn't fall asleep.
Is that what was hurting you, the lack of flesh to have the bones?
That's right. And what's more, and you see, you've got to understand that the bunks were only 2 foot, and there were two of us. And it was, and however small we were, there was not enough room for us to lie on our backs. So every time, one had to change, the other one had to change around. So we used to wake each other up because we couldn't help it, because equally our bones were hurting. But that night when I suddenly discovered that my flesh was gone, I didn't sleep, because it really frightened me. And I thought, what's happening to me now? Anyway, I recovered from it, but like everything else, you learn to live with it.
Were you just sleeping on bare wood, or did you have any?
It wasn't bare wood. It was a piece of paper, piece of sort of hard paper.
Covering the wood.
Covering the wood.
And did you have a blanket?
We had a blanket, yes, which was lice-ridden. At that stage, our bodies were absolutely red, and the flesh was torn. Naps on, all scratches all over.
What was the attitude of the guards in the camp? Did it change noticeably at all as the...
Well, yes, with some it was, and with some it didn't. Some just carried on in the same way as nothing has happened. And others went on as they realized that the war was coming to an end, and therefore their attitudes changed as well. But the German women's attitudes changed perceptibly, and every day more and more. And when they realized, and then one day, I remember the forewoman came up, and she was saying to me and some other boys, she said, "We hear such terrible stories, what the Russians are doing to our women. There are 10, 12 of them are raping one woman. If it would be one-to-one, I could understand, you know." We were very amused by that. But 10, can you imagine? They're animals, they're Mongols, you know. And he said, "Yes, yes, yes." And we thought, what a marvelous thing is happening, you know. It was really, but it was music to our ears, all this. I mean, because suddenly they were complaining, they were running to us, to ask for sympathy from us. It was a great change. Our morale was growing from day to day, in spite of the fact that others were with people are falling by the wayside, in spite of the fact that our bodies were emaciated and thin. But, as I said, the air raids, the German attitude, all this was changed. But something happened one day that really made me feel that I am invincible and indestructible. And it did a lot for me, because suddenly the door opened and a German officer came out shouting, "Raus, raus!" Out, out. Outside there was a lorry, and he ordered us to load up the lorry with the boxes that were there. Because he came straight from the front to take these anti-tank weapons to the front. The front was only about 70, 80 miles away from us. And I found myself on the lorry. And he was in such a hurry that he himself was on the lorry too. So, and I was with him. And the others were passing the boxes. So I was taking off the boxes from the other boys, and I was throwing them up higher and higher to the top. And he was a big fellow. I'm not much bigger now. I was a very small boy. And he kept on shouting, "Weitermachen, weitermachen, that's quickly, quickly." And for sort of a second, when we were waiting for them to bring us the boxes, he sort of looked at me, and he looked up, and he said, "How is this possible?" He says, "Where do you get this strength from?" And I sort of felt good, you know. I said, "Well, I'm a strong boy, you know. I had to be strong." Anyway, he didn't say anything. We loaded up the lorry. He then told everybody to go back to the hut, and he said, "You come with me." For a minute I was frightened. I thought, what is he going to do to me? But he seemed very friendly, and he was very impressed with the way I worked with him. So I thought to myself, well, maybe he's going to give me something, I don't know. Anyway, drove up to the German kitchen. He stopped and he said, "You come with me." Brinton went to the manager there and he said to him, "Will you give this boy as much food as he can eat?" He says, "I don't know where he gets his strength from, but he deserves a good meal." I got a plate of soup. Well, I tell you, it was the most delicious food I have ever eaten. I mean, the way it felt at the time. I haven't eaten something like this for I didn't remember the time. It was so tasty. It was so wholesome. I ate that first plateful in a matter of a. I must have ate it so quickly that when I went up for another helping, the manager said to me, "I've just given it to you. What have you done with it?" I said, "I've eaten it." He says, "What?" And he smiled, poured in another plateful. This time I was eating it very nicely, slowly. And I went up to him. I sort of summoned my courage a little bit. And I said, and timidly, I said to him, "May I have another one?" And he looked at me. And he said, "Oh, you do have an appetite." I said, "Yes, you know," and I smiled. And I finished it. I didn't have the courage to go for the 4-star. And I walked away, and once again, I thought, I'm in heaven. I thought to myself, this is going to last me. I worked out in terms of what I've eaten in the last week, and comparing to that, thought to myself, this is going to last me at least for 1 week. And since the front is so near, maybe in 1 week we'll be delivered. You know, I was sort of working out all kinds of permutations, you know.
Did it not in any way give you an upset stomach, suddenly being able to eat such a lot?
No, it didn't. Because it still wasn't enough. I came back, I told the boys what happened, and I was so sorry. Because they listened to me, and I suddenly realized that my happiness was their sadness. Because they were so hungry, and I couldn't wait to tell them what has happened to me. But I realized that was psychologically a very bad move. And I was very upset, and I sort of stopped after that, because I stopped talking about it. But inside me, I could think of nothing else. Luck that befell upon me. Well, I mentioned to you that at the time when I came, when we were sent to Steben, I was given some advice what to do by the Blockältester. And of course, when I arrived in Steben, my mind was preoccupied, apart from food, was also preoccupied with the idea of how to get back to Buchenwald. And I couldn't think of anything that was wrong with me. So I thought that since I had trouble with my appendix, I will pretend that I've got pain in the appendix. So it was amazing what autosuggestion can do. And suddenly I was beginning to get that pain.
And you hadn't felt it?
Didn't feel it good. It's only when I started, when I thought of this idea that this is the only way that I'll go back. So I went to the sick bay. And I said, I can't work, and I've got this pain. So they couldn't, they didn't know what to do. They said, they put my name down for the next transport to go to Regenstadt, back to Buchenwald. This was after the first month. And I felt very happy, and I thought, well, but in the meantime, I started getting this pain. In order to justify my excuse, I was really experiencing it. Oh, so I thought. Well, when it came to be sent away, they found that they had more pressing people who were in much worse condition than I was. And so they left me behind. And they said, well, we will try and send you the next time. And about another month went by, and again, was time for my I was going to be sent away. I didn't go out to work, and I was going to be sent to Buchenwald. That same day, an order came from some headquarters that they needed 200 or 150 people for another camp, and they wanted it from our place. And they picked out the people who went to work. So my friend with whom I was sharing the bunk, he went out to work, and I was waiting to be sent away. He came back and he said to me, you know what happened? They are sending us away to another camp. So now when they send these people away, they didn't have enough people, so the ones who were going to go to Buchenwald, they didn't send away. So I was left behind. Had I not been trying to go back to Buchenwald, I would have been like my friend. I would have also been sent to this other camp. And that other camp turned out to be even worse than the one that we had. Because I met up with this friend after the war, and he told me when he got there, because the reason why they took people from this camp was because they were building another factory there. And they were building it from scratch, and there was no room for them where to sleep. They were sleeping almost on the outside.